You were listening to Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes fraudulently, because that was always Teddy Pendergrass. Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. I thought that would be appropriate for the lead-in to the show, because y'all know music not only matters in terms of how it makes us feel, but it also ties into the times that we're living in. So welcome to the April 18th edition of Uncle Bobby's Country Corner, where real men don't play. This is going to be a fast-moving show. The theme for today is the business of sports and entertainment. And before the phrase OG meant what it does now, to my right, this gentleman here was an OG, an original gentleman. So I want you to welcome to the show today, former Los Angeles Lakers. And we'll get into some of his history, but right now he's a retired gentleman. Welcome Jerry Chambers to Uncle Bobby's Country Corner.
Thank you, Bob.
You're more than welcome. To my immediate left, I just met this brother a few weeks ago out in Santa Monica. And immediately, I just felt his spirit being what it is. Because like they say, birds of a feather flock together. And so please welcome to Uncle Bobby's Country Corner, Dr. Andre Brown.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, man, it's an honor. To my far left.
Always.
Y'all know that's Cousin Vic. All right. And the reason I chose the subject matter that's a recurring theme of our show going forward, the business of sports and entertainment. All of us here at some point in our lives participated in some level of sports activity. And to the highest degree, the brother to my far right performed at the elite level. Originally, he's from Washington, D.C. He made a name for himself back in the late 50s?
No, not that far back, Bobby.
Oh, okay.
Back in the 60s, baby.
Well, that must be lint you got on your chin. One other thing that he and I share is a common birthday with Nelson Mandela, July the 18th. Jerry starred at the high school level, then he went to the University of Utah, and he has the distinction of being the only player in the history of the NCAA to be named the most outstanding player, which was comparable to an MVP award on a losing team. What year was that, Jerry?
1966.
And what was interesting about that year, it was also the year that some of y'all, if you didn't see the movie when it first came out, you would find it inspiring to see the movie. In the semifinals, Jerry and his teammates played against Texas Western, which was the first team to start five black players, if I'm correct.
That is correct.
And in the first half of that game, how many did you put in, Jerry?
I scored something like 25.
It wasn't something like 25. Yeah, 25 in the first half, you know. And we have a running conversation about why they lost, you know, because as LeVar Ball said, you know.
I can take him.
You can't beat these brothers. Oh, my Lord. And then you went on to a career in the NBA. Who all did you play with in the National Basketball Association?
I played with the Los Angeles Lakers. Mm-hmm. Actually, I got traded for Will Chamberlain from the Lakers to Philadelphia.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay.
But a little hiccup in my career, I got drafted into the Army at that time. And Philadelphia took my rights and traded my rights to the Phoenix Suns.
Mm. Did you play with Connie Hawkins?
I'm getting ready to tell you the story right now. That was a time when I got traded to Phoenix. Connie Hawkins was two people. It was Kareem, which was Lou Alcindor at the time, and Connie Hawkins. And it was a coin flip at that time. And Milwaukee flipped the coin. They did it over the telephone, and they flipped the coin and said, oh, Milwaukee gets Lou Alcindor, and the Phoenix Suns get Connie Hawkins.
Wow.
That's how it went down. And I was with him when he first got into the NBA.
The Hawk. For the younger segment of our listening audience, you would probably know more about Dr. J. Connie Hawkins was Dr. J before Dr. J and Michael Jordan. Okay, just an incredible high flyer and a prolific scorer and an amazing basketball player. Now, you also finished college, if I'm correct.
Yes, I did.
In that era.
I was lucky.
You were smart, man. Come on, I ain't got time for that, man. You were smart, man.
Right.
They don't give away degrees. You know, they do now, but back then you had to earn one.
They wasn't giving away at Utah.
I know.
Not at all.
Yeah.
I have a question for you, but before I ask my question, let me just go real country on you all. When Bob and I used to be back on the corner, a couple of nice, dapper brothers would come up to us. We'd say, "What are y'all singing at tonight?" Looking good, y'all. Oh, I'm telling you. How did you like back then? How did you like your? How was your experience at Utah?
Okay, this is how. Coming from D.C., which where I grew up, I wasn't exposed to too many white people. You know, I wasn't exposed to them.
Chocolate City.
But they were. I mean, they were around. We had to play against the Matha High School, who had white players, all different things. But my social background wasn't around them. So I didn't go to Utah right away. I went to a junior college in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
Junior college called Trinidad State Junior College in Colorado. And I went down there, and that's where I started to get the exposure of being around a lot of white men, a lot of Latinos, everything like that. And I started to, you know, broaden my horizons, listening, not talking all the time, but listening and understanding, you know, what is going on in this world, you know, what's going on. So I left when I went to Trinidad. Matter of fact, Spencer Haywood went to Trinidad too, junior college. Matter of fact, Spencer Haywood made the Olympic team in 68 when he went there. He was at junior college when he went to the Olympics.
Wow.
And and me and him are very tight to this day. And I tell him all the time, he couldn't come close to breaking any of my records at Trinidad.
Okay.
And just for historical context, Spencer Haywood revolutionized the game off the court with respect to being the first player that went directly to the NBA on that hardship rule, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
Yeah. And that changed the whole thing to the point where now we're back to
one
that almost with one and
we're
done.
One and done now. Yeah.
All right. As I set the stage for the conversation of business, the business of sports and entertainment, let me qualify why this brother is sitting to my immediate left. I kind of just briefly got into a little bit about who he is, and it's better since I know him, but I don't know him. I know his spirit and his heart. So if you would, share with my audience a little about your history and how you bleed into the subject matter that we have today.
Yeah. So I'm originally from North Carolina and grew up in New York. My father's he was a minister. So grew up in the church, grew around a lot of different types of people. And then went to school, like you said, played sports, you know, for fun and, you know, in high school and everything like that. And then got to college and I ended up majoring in psychology at Elizabeth City State University in North Carolina, small black college.
Sure.
Right.
And then I went to University of Maryland Eastern Shore for my master's in school counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Seton Hall in New Jersey for my PhD in family psychology.
Mm.
So I'm a psychologist and family therapist.
Okay.
And I work with families. I work with athletes, as we spoke earlier. And really what started me thinking about it was realizing early in my life, I said, okay, well, I want to play basketball. I want to do this. I want to do that. But I'm like, my quickest ticket to getting to where I need to go is going to be through my education.
Mm.
So we had like a point guard that was like 6'3". I knew he was better than me because he beat me all the time at home. We had some other
ballers,
people.
Yeah.
We had one high school in my area, in my county. Mm-hmm. So if you're not that dude in the third, fourth, fifth grade, unless you're coming in from somewhere and you're already – you know, five star, you're not going to make it.
You've been stereotyped.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So for my, with a lot of my work is working with families, working with youth, working with men. A lot of work is around working with African-American and black men.
Mm-hmm.
And so working with folks on different, from either at home, through churches, through the community, then there's a lot of athletes and folks go to college. And then being on college campuses, dealing with a lot of issues that athletes have to manage is being a part of my work. And so understanding not only from wanting to be an athlete, you know, as far as making it to that next level, college level, but also knowing the struggles of being with classmates and everyone else, and then having a chance to do some consultation. I have a consulting practice as well, working with I did some work with University of Oregon football team, some other teams like that, trying to just help them understand where they are. And for me, it's really more about raising the consciousness of athletes.
Mm.
And also knowing that there's a life beyond the athletics, mm-hmm. and the more well-rounded you are as a person, the better you're going to perform on in your prospective sport. Right. And because after that, then it's really about being a whole human and being conscious about what you're doing when you're doing it.
So you're here for the next few days in one of your, I guess, side businesses. Mm-hmm. Speak to your relationship with the city of Los Angeles.
And so also through my consulting business, I'm a consultant to the gang reduction youth development program out of the mayor's office for the city of Los Angeles. So with that work, I work out of the mayor's office in City Hall. And also go into the community with all the agencies that are funded through the GRID program. So the city provides funding to agencies all across the city of Los Angeles that are in the highest needs or the highest risk where there's more violence related to gangs. Mm-hmm. And so they provide services to families, intervention and prevention work.
What does GRID stand for?
Gang Reduction Youth Development.
Gang Reduction?
Youth Development.
Oh, okay. All right. I was getting ready to spell it with an I.
G-R-Y-D.
Yeah, G-R-Y-D.
G-R-Y-D. Yep. Okay. Now, I met you through a kindred spirit. Mm-hmm. And when he introduced you, he said, "This is my brother mm-hmm. from another mother. And I'm speaking of a remarkable soldier by the name of David Banner." How mm-hmm. did you guys become friends?
We actually met in graduate school.
At?
University of Maryland, Eastern Shore.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was getting his master's in teacher education, and I came in the same year in the school counseling program. Mm. So we worked in the computer lab together. Mm. And so we just started hanging out, became friends. We ended up being roommates, and he left school to put out his first album. Mm-hmm. He was already signed when he got there, was working out the details, and had to make a tough decision to either become a teacher or follow the dream to be a rap artist. And he left, and then we stayed in contact, and I actually run his nonprofit now.
And what's the name of that organization?
The Banner Foundation.
The Banner Foundation.
Yeah, and we used to call it was Heal the Hood. And that's where it launched, mm-hmm. actually, after Hurricane Katrina and devastated all the stuff in the Gulf region.
Right, right.
He started going down and doing a lot of work in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we continued the organization to now.
Now, you're far more than a sidekick based on the conversations we've had. So. Mm-hmm. You, as the director of that program, you also have an equity position in the foundation, right?
Yeah, I spend a lot of money. So equity is something that, it's not a lot of money going. But no, I'm the president, mm-hmm. the president of it. It's his organization. It's really a family organization. Mm-hmm. It's him and his family and my family. As far as like, the people we bring in, is a very close circle. Mm-hmm. And part of it, even with him and same with athletes, a lot of times people question what you're doing. And him coming from rap and like crunk kind of hardcore rap music, mm-hmm. People, we was like, we want to do for ourselves first before we ask anybody else for anything. Mm-hmm. So over this year is the first year we really opened it up for people to start donating more.
Oh, okay.
Because we wanted to really brand it and say, we put in money, we're not asking for nothing, these are our people, we're going to do what we need to do, and then really growing it organic and learning the business, mm-hmm. and also rebranding him. He was going through, you know, as a young man, different changes and, mm-hmm. and things going in his life. And we didn't want to be beholden to anyone else and have any other interest dictating our platform.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason I use the word equity is because based on the original conversation we had, you actually put some money up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important because one of the ongoing and the central theme of this show is models of possibility mm-hmm. and best practice. And by models of possibility, I mean let's find where people are not only talking the talk, but walking the walk. Mm-hmm. And what are some of the things that you guys have poured into various communities so far as a nonprofit organization?
We've partnered with Boys and Girls Club, Big Brothers Big Sisters, a lot of homeless shelters. This is one organization called SWAT, Sisters with a Throttle. Mm-hmm. It's a black female biker gang. Down there. And this will call sisters because they have access to folks that most people can't get to.
Wow.
And that's our thing, is really trying to get folks that other people are leaving behind. So if there's a list of all the families that are going to get gifts, we want the families that can't get on the list, the ones that are so far removed, they're not going to get those services.
Mm-hmm.
And so bringing resources, partnering with purchasing gifts, and really making packages for families. So then it was kind of like, first was giving gifts and supporting folks, and then we're like, well, we really need to get to the needs. So then we started getting into buying beds and clothes and more of like utensils. Some families had never eaten off of real plates.
Mm-hmm.
And then now We've also we moved away from wanting to start arts education and athletic complex because there's so much money, like you said, opportunity. So much money it takes to generate it,
yeah, right.
And infrastructure. And then
sure. We
both of us, neither one of us were in a position to move back to Mississippi and do that full time.
Mm-hmm.
So then we said, well, we'll be better off leveraging our resources. So we committed to build studios into the Boys and Girls Club. So we dedicated our first one two Christmases ago at the Boys and Girls Club in Jackson. So they have a full studio, music studio. They retrofitted place. A lot of his original equipment that he made his first records on is in there.
Mm.
And so now we're going to build seven Boys and Girls Club in the greater Jackson area.
Okay. Wow.
So that's what we did. So they're all going to be named the Band of Studios.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of figuring out how to leverage and partner and say what can be sustainable and going to be the best bang for the buck and impact for the community than for us is to have another space and create programming. So we're starting to do more of that. And mainly, a lot of it is also supporting a lot of the local organizations and bringing them together. Because sometimes you can be in a space where you're doing good work and you're doing good work, but they're not talking to each other.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
With through our efforts, we're able to kind of bring some folks to the table that may not normally be there all the time consistently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
So, Jerry, I'm sorry I had to keep my phone on because it's some things central to this show today that are happening around the nation, and that was a phone call from Chicago. And you'll hear more about what it is that's getting ready to happen because of the ability to bring like minds together. I am set on the fact that it's not necessary to have a whole lot of folks, but you need a core group of people who have comparable skills, but not necessarily the same skills that get things done. And then you can project back to the masses with that once you get that accord together. And on that note, after you left the NBA, you stayed here in Los Angeles. And what have you been doing the last X number of years?
Well,
Jerry Chambers.
You know, when you come to L.A., you know, I've been hitting in L.A., then the last team I played for was San Antonio Spurs. And I was in San Antonio.
Move a little closer.
I was in San Antonio, and for some reason I got the acting bug came on me for some reason. So I said, I'm going back to L.A. But the main reason I came back to L.A. was that I had my son was here. And I'm working out with him and training him, he's trying to be like me, playing ball and everything. And so I got into the acting business and stuff like that. So, of course, being a black man in L.A. trying to be an actor, you didn't get too much work, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you had a lot of time to spend with your kids and stuff. So I spent with him. And my son was playing basketball one day, and he collapsed on the floor, you know. And I said, wait a minute, hold it. What's going on? And he collapsed, and passed away right there in front of me, right there. And I know I'm going around the
no,
circle.
No, this is very
take
important.
Your time. Yeah.
But he collapsed right there at Westchester Park, Westchester, right down the street from Westchester High School. And I was so devastated, I couldn't do anything. I was out of it for at least about 3-4 months, and still over the years haven't recovered from that. Mm-hmm. He was 13 years old.
Oh, wow.
So big kid, getting ready, you know, looked like he's getting ready to do something. But what happened after that, a lady came to me. She was the head of, Recreation and Parks. And she offered me a position saying that, hey, why don't you come and work with some kids, do something with some kids and stuff. And at that time, I was still devil. I said, I don't even think I want to do that. And the way it came down is that she said, well, just do it part-time. Okay, I go to LA Recreation and Parks, and I take the tests, all that stuff and everything, interviews and everything like that. So they called me about 3 weeks later. They called me and said, oh, you ready to come to work? I said, oh, yeah, I'm coming to work. Well, you got this park down in Rosecrans Recreation. I got a park. What do you mean? I got a
park. They gave you a park.
I didn't want a park. I thought I was doing a part-time thing, and you know, I can work with different. She said, "Well, no, you go down there, and we're going to set you up down at Rosecrans Recreation Center." I was there for a year, and we did some great things down there with the kids. Did a lot of good things with the kids. Of course, how they do things, the more successful you get, they send you to Westwood.
Sure, yeah, sure.
Take you out of your element, yeah, right. And put you in, oh, well, we need Jerry Chambers. We need him, ex-Laker. We need him up here with these people.
With his expertise.
Yeah, he don't be down here with the brothers. You know?
You don't want to be wasting that goodness on them.
Don't waste that on them. That's right? Exactly right.
Yeah.
So then they moved me up there. So after a while, I went up there. And what really changed everything for me, I went up there. And I was there, and a lot of Persian kids were up there, a lot of rich people and everything like that. And we did form a pretty good program with them, helping them out and doing little things and stuff like that. And one day, another lady came and said, "Jerry, why don't you go over to Westchester?"
Wow.
I said, "No, Westchester." She said, "We want you over there in Westchester Park." I said, "You know, I don't know if I can handle that." Because that's where my son passed away, right on that basketball court over there.
Wow.
So they said, "Well, just go over there and see, you know." And I said, "No." I said, "Nah, let me hold off on that." But I did go. I snuck around and went around there and walked on that floor and looked. And I said to myself, I said, "Wow, my son ain't here. My son is gone on. He's gone on to another place, a better place, and everything like that." And all of a sudden, it was like, maybe I could help some other kids. Mm. Maybe God took my son and gave me some other kids to raise. And from that time on, that's 25 years. Mm. I go 25 years in Reckon Park of having kids. I've got kids that have gone to Harvard. I got kids that have gone all over. The kid playing for Portland Trailblazers, Alan Crabb.
Right.
His people are the
Pastor.
Pastor.
Crenshaw Christian Center.
Yeah. That's his name?
Pastor Crenshaw Christian Center. Fred Price.
Fred Price's grandson.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But he played in the program, came out. Because we used to have little tutoring sessions and stuff. We had all kinds of stuff going on and everything. And over the years, I've got kids that graduated from Las Vegas. They went to Nevada, Las Vegas, all kinds of stuff. They were good basketball players, but now they're out in the world. Mm-hmm. And the model that I used for them was James Brown. Now, James Brown I'm talking about is the James Brown who does football.
Oh, yeah.
Went
to Syracuse, yeah.
No, he went to Yale.
He went to Harvard.
Harvard.
Okay, okay.
But he's from D.C.
Okay.
And he was a basketball player. Mm-hmm. He was the best basketball player at DeMatha High School his junior year.
Mm-hmm.
And I used him as a really good model because his senior year in high school, he's still a great player, everything. But he started passing out in games. Started collapsing in games.
Mm.
Boom. So all the schools in the nation wanted him. 6'6", bad boy, jump high, shoot it and everything. And everybody wanted him. But he realized that basketball wasn't going to be the thing for him. So he went to Harvard, came out with a law degree. He tried to play a little ball for the Bullets, but he ended up being the announcer. And then he ended up signing with CBS, and everything else is history. And I tell everybody, all those kids, "Oh, we want to play ball. We want to be." And Jerry, you with the Lakers? Tell them. I said, "Wait a minute, hold it. Look at James Brown. I had his autobiography. I had everything, all this stuff." You know? I said, "Look at this gentleman here. Look where he is." And this, but you know, and that was my whole premise, man. I always felt like that. I helped a lot of kids, and they went on. I still see their families and everything. They still ask me to, like, some of them were young now, and they, like, in high school, getting ready to graduate, getting ready to go to college, and me counseling them and helping them out and stuff like that. But sometimes it just takes certain things to, certain tragedies in my life to take it off. I didn't tell you the full thing. It's because his mother passed away. My wife passed away 6 months after my son was born.
So you were a single parent.
I was a single parent up there. I wasn't alone. I had my in-laws. They were here. My mother was still back in D.C. and my in-laws here, and so they helped me when I was
created
moved.
A village.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then shoot, man. After then, my in-laws they passed away. They were all older people. So they and. At that time, I was all alone. So I was working with these kids. I was all by myself, man. That was unbelievable.
But see, here's the interesting thing. 25 years you did that.
I did it for 25
years you did that.
Right, right.
And basically what you did then was teaching kids to use basketball as a stepping stone to something else.
Exactly.
It wasn't the end game.
Right.
It wasn't the end game, you know.
So the purpose of this show today, the business of sports and entertainment, is to build off of these success stories, how you have evolved into more than just what appears on your pedigree. Mm-hmm. All right, this brother's life story, the things that we've all made contributions that are not expected of us as African American men, and it's not trying to stick our chests out, but we've got a multitude of problems right now, and there's no panacea, but there's a lot of different ways that we can collaborate around the business of sports and entertainment. For example, I mentioned last week and the week before and the week before that, the National Association of Minority Contractors, along with the American Foundation for Social Change, are integral to everything that I do. And in Columbia, South Carolina, June 15th through the 17th, there will be the annual convention. And the theme is the business of sports and entertainment. And between now and the end of June, the collaborations that start right here at this table will be an integral part of a conference that says, look, let's look at sports and entertainment and how we plug in more people than just the athletes and the entertainers. And it's conceivable because they are willing people, like Brother Brown, like this brother here, Jerry Chambers, my cousin, and some more people that we are going to be in constant communication with. Matter of fact, I was speaking with Sam Watson earlier this morning on a three-way conversation. Sam Watson, for those of y'all don't know, is the face of boxing. Most people think he's Al Haymon. Okay.
Yeah, right.
But he's not really.
Right. Every time you look in the ring, there's Sam.
Right. And MGM, they just had a fight in D.C. You was in town last week when they had the fight in D.C.?
No, I was heading out here.
Y'all, you was, okay. And they sold out of cognac because the brothers and sisters came out.
They go heavy.
And so I called Sam.
They go heavy.
And MGM took notice of that. Mm-hmm. They like, wait a minute. We need to have more of these fights. Mm-hmm. But our objective is to say, nah, we just don't want people coming in there putting money in. We want to be a part of all aspects of a production, whether it's an entertainment event. I mean, there's room at this stage for David Banner to come and do the God Box series sponsored by MGM. Mm-hmm. So we're looking, we're pulling all the stops out at this point because we are the content. And there's billions and billions, if not even $1 trillion worldwide that we create. And for the most part, other than the direct participants, we are not engaged in the money-making side of that. And that has to stop because we've seen time and time again that poverty is a serial killer. Mm-hmm. The brother that killed his wife out there in San Bernardino was living beyond his means. He drove a BMW. She drove a BMW. They had a big old house. Money gets funny. She leave him. They both end up in the grave. Okay. This brother that just killed this brother in Cleveland.
Cleveland.
Gambling problem.
Sure.
Not enough money. And what did he do? He take a good man's life.
He was a counselor, too.
Yeah. But not practicing what he preached because money and women are the two things that people kill over. And so we're looking at this holistically in terms of what are the root causes of our condition? and having a brother that's been dealing, how many years you been doing work with the mind, so to speak?
Man, since I say undergrad, 97.
Since 1997. So we're getting the best of the best, and we're going to lock arms and address the real issues that have the communities that we're from, the communities that we live in complete chaos. Jerry is also very close friends with a mutual associate that y'all heard us talk about. We do this show with OG Portis and Brother Quincy, who owns the building, and she built it out with her own sweat equity, right? Right here on Crenshaw Boulevard. And right up the street is Maverick Flats. And it's run by a longtime friend of his who also played in the NFL, Brother Seth Cartwright. And we're going to continue to have this discussion on how to make sure if we don't save nothing else, we start saving historic landmarks that can become cash cows that are right in this corridor that every week we come in here, we see the transformation of it. Because you stay in this community when you come to town. Yeah. And you're seeing more and more white folks every day. Every time you come here, you see more white people. Yeah. And it's no sense in us complaining about that. Right. Let's get in a position where we can get some of their money by providing a range of services right. And then just building on that model of best practices. So we're going to take a short pause and then we're going to dig into the second half of this show. We'll be right back. Hell down before. Keep it going.
Hell down anymore.
Y'all know what?
Don't let nothing
stand in your way. Y'all act like y'all don't know this song.
I thought you were going to take the high note. I thought you were about to climb on up.
That's only when I'm on the corner. That's, man.
That's why we call it. That's what we used to do. Uncle Bobby's corner. Yeah, country corner.
Yeah,
we tearing up.
Ain't no stopping us now, y'all. Yeah. You know, eventually when we upgrade what we do here, you'll get some of the outtakes. But since we couldn't, we're going to recreate the conversation we had while we were on that short pause for the call. And, Victor, you were sharing something inspired by your story.
Sure.
That I want you to share with our audience.
Basically, I was talking to Jerry and the guys about my experience with my son and looking past basketball as a stepping stone to something else. I used to coach. I was real energetic in coaching my son, but I was smart enough, or I was pushed by my wife to make sure that we had a proper balance. I got a counselor next to me, so I got to roll with this right. So, you know, I said, look, baby, if you think I get too far out of line, now you have the right to pull us back in. And she did that. But the interesting thing about it, she was an educator. She worked in Pasadena, LA Unified. She always made sure that we sat down and talked about school. We talked about school at the dinner table. We knocked out a wall in our house to create a bigger create an office for our son. Mm-hmm. And so, to make a long story short, he ended up going to Brown University. In his undergrad degree, and then he moved back out here. He went to work. He was an intern at Boeing while he was in college, and basically got a job with Boeing for 5 years, and then decided he wanted to do something else because as he was like 21, he says, Dad, these are old people. You know, Boeing's an old engineering firm.
Right.
He said, these people are old over here. I don't want to work with these people. So after he got a job at CBS in the finance department, and basically got his MBA from USC, and now he's a finance manager for CBS. He handles the Viacom account.
Okay.
He has an office at CBS headquarters, but he works with Viacom. Yeah. So basically, athletics. See, I looked at it like this. You know, coming from old school, see, I didn't have parents, but athletics gave me discipline, taught me how to show up on time, how taught me how to take instruction. The only thing it didn't teach me was how to lose. And that room, I couldn't coach anymore.
I taught you how to lose real quick.
Yeah. I couldn't coach. I had to get out of coaching. Became a private businessman, had a general contractor, got into the acoustical consulting business, and that was my profession. I couldn't take losing. It was traumatic for me. I'll tell you a quick story. I was coaching the AAU team, and, you know, all the kids go to Las Vegas for the Big Easter tournament. We made it to the finals. We made it to the finals, and we were winning the game. I had this 1-3-1 zone trap cooking, and my kids got tired. We lost the game. I walked back to the Alexis Hotel, went to the hotel room, got under the cover, and didn't come out until my wife and kid got back to the room, and my wife was kicking me and beating me, saying,
"What's wrong with you?"
Said, "What's wrong with you? Mm-hmm. We calling the police. We looking for you all over town." I mean, I got the blanket over my head.
Oh,
I said, "Man, I lost that game." She says, "You know what? We need to talk when we get back home." Mm-hmm. And that was it. I think that was the last game I coached. Yeah.
So just to show that this is not just your typical let's talk about it scenario.
We lived it.
When David Banner came out here, what was that, about a month ago now?
Yeah, about a month.
We had a very important meeting because when I first met David on another radio show a little over a year ago, it was like first thing he did was show some reverence because I look as old as I am. And he was so respectful. I didn't know where he was from. I really didn't know very much about him, okay? And he was, "Yes, sir." And I'm like, "Hold on, man. They kissing your butt over here, man, you know?" And he was like, "Man, I just raised that way." Then he told me where he was from. And then once I found out who he was, nothing changed really because I wasn't into him for his celebrity. I was into him for his humanity, right? And so as we evolved to sitting here right now, it has led to, at the end of this show, Brother Brown and Victor and I are going to ride up to Jim Brown's house to advance a conversation on how we start merging these lanes. And as we prepare to do that, man, what are your thoughts about going up to Jim's house this evening and what might come out of that meeting?
Have you met Jim before?
We spoke briefly on the phone
last time I was out here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I never had a chance to meet him. It's going to be an honor. I think it's one of those things where it's a lot of different sides. Right? One is like you want to go take a picture and have him sign my jacket. Right? Like, just sign this, right? Just sign something. But then the other side is you recognizing that this stuff is bigger than me or him or anybody at this table. It's about our people and about, you know, how we're going to actually make some changes. And I think it's kind of like you maturing into a space. For me, it's like, you know, you're little. And then you always think you little because even when you get grown, and then you realize that you're the one that everybody's looking at. Right? So, like, I'm still young. I still feel like a kid. I'm sitting here with y'all, like you said, being respectful, y'all. Mm-hmm. I ain't gonna talk until y'all tell me to talk.
Wow.
Right? Because I know we stay in my lane.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the same time, I am one of the ones that are in a position that actually do have leverage and can make some things happen and have done it historically. So it's also opportunity to be in a position to be led, right, and be in a position to be used, and to make myself available. And that's kind of the way I was raised.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like, you know, you do what you do and you do it really well, but you know that the gift is coming from somewhere else, and this also can be taken somewhere else.
Mm.
And one thing, like you talking about stories, like one time my dad, I played saxophone. That was the other thing. When I got in school, I got really into big in music.
Mm.
So I had a band. It was all horns, and we had a keyboard player. We had singers. We firing people. We thought we were going to be Earth, Wind, and Fire. I'm kicking people out of the car on the side of the road.
Earth, Wind, and Fire.
We was going to do it.
James Brown.
Like, James Brown. And it was funny because my dad, he was a rock and roll musician, and gospel. So we would our church services were like we had like a five piece. We had like a 10-piece band.
Mm.
So you get the full experience.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember one time I was feeling kind of sick, and I didn't want to play that Sunday. And we was in the pulpit, and I told my dad, I said, "I really don't feel like playing." He's like, "What's wrong with you?" I'm like, "So you had a game last night. I played marching band."
Mm-hmm.
And and then I did some other stuff, and he was like, "Well, something." He knew I had some attitude. I don't know what it was. But he was like, "I hope God give you lockjaw." I'm like, "Hold up, player. You can't curse me in the pulpit before church." Right?
So I'm like, court church.
Right? I'm like, "I'll never say that again." So it's that sense of, so I played my butt off. You know what I'm saying? And it's that sense of you have something as a talent. It's only for the building of God's kingdom and helping our people.
Mm.
So to be in a position where something I can do or be a part of, or because of the affiliations in organizations, allowed me to be in a space where something might happen and I can be a part of it, then I'm willing to be there and try to make myself available. And that's kind of how I've learned to move, because, and even we're talking about the sports, you have to be well-rounded, and you never know which one of your talents is going to be the thing that they need at a particular time. A team or in business, you might think you're the best defender, but they need you for offense. Whatever that move is.
It's about winning.
You want to win and be available for however you're going to be used. So thank you for the opportunity to be in this position.
Well, since when you didn't feel like playing, you're probably too young to gamble, so it must have been a woman. Since Bobby said women and gamble kill women and money, women and money is our downfall.
And I'm cheap. So it was probably an expensive woman.
Every day is truly a school day, because I'm as much a fan of my own show than I am the driving force, because I learn so much about the people that I associate with, things that I wouldn't have known had I not done this show. And it makes sense to me now why you and David are like brothers, man, because I'm serious. The look on Banner's face when he told me, he said, man, this ain't just this dude, man. This is my brother right here. And I took it the way he meant that. Mm. And now that you explained the musical connection, it's one thing to go to school with somebody and be a roommate. That could just be coincidental. Mm-hmm. But to have those spirits merge and then have that ability to understand the dynamics of what this brother decided to do, it explains the longevity of your relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, Jerry, now that you done walked into this, what are some of the thoughts going through your head as you see what we're dealing with in terms of the ambition of this initiative, the business of sports and entertainment being a backdrop?
Well, I'm just interested. I'm just glad you asked me to come, because it's beautiful to listen to this brother over here speak, and talk about what his motivational factors are and everything like that. I think, we need more brothers like him to do what you're talking about, as far as linking the entertainment with the sports and the sports with the business side of us. Because we got some people, they ain't get a lot of recognition. Magic Johnson and all these guys get all the math. But I don't know if we're really reaching what we should be getting to. There's a lot of people out here that need help, man, needs things and stuff like that. I see it every day. Mm-hmm. But since I retired, I kind of like stopped, I said, let me stop. And I just sit there and look at CNN, seeing how, I don't know if I should say that, but seeing how Trump is messing up this country and how people are responding to it and everything like that. But we need to come together as a group of people, man. We need to do this. We need to come. People who have some assets and have some things that they can contribute, we can do this. And this brother here is magnificent, man. He's a magnificent brother. The one
but guys, it all boils down to is that sooner or later, we're going to have to cross that bridge where we get real serious about investing in our own community.
Exactly.
And basically, as long as we depend on others to do that for us, we're always going to be beholden to them, and we're going to be dependent on how much money they're giving it, and the political tone at that particular time, and that can be a problem.
And I think about it like it's really, for me, most everything goes back to family, right? That's my general
foundation.
Everything's going to be family. If something right with you, it's your family. Something wrong with you, it's your family. Mm-hmm. Right, and you never know what it is that, that make you who you are and what you do. Right, it's all those things all mixed together.
Sure,
right? But I think what I find is parents don't commit to the kid's whole wellness. Mm. Right, they want one part of it. Like you saying with you and your wife, right?
Sure.
You said I'm gonna take this lane and do the athletics. She's gonna do education.
Sure.
Most parents don't say, I just want my kid to be solid. Mm. If you're a part of every single aspect of your child's life, they're not going to be in a position where they're going to be taken advantage of. Because you're going to know something about it from the beginning. Mm. So if you're taking your kid to practice, basketball practice, violin practice, they doing church stuff, they, running the streets, they going to their friend's house, you're fully invested in every aspect of their life. There's no way they're going to go to a college and not do their homework.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing I saw working with college athletes, is like you're in a room with folks, and they get in trouble for fighting or getting rape charges and just dumb stuff, right? Just because usually it's dumbness that's going on, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how did you get to be the valedictorian of your high school class, captain of the football team, did 100,000 hours of community service, and then you get to college and you get to be dumb?
Right?
Because it's like you lost your sense when you came to college because they're creating a space where they want to dumb you down so you can be a flunky or be someone that can be pushed and moved and not asserting, they're not affirming your manhood, right? Not manhood like being just macho, but being, you know, a fully developed human.
Right.
You know, so, that's a beautiful segue into why I advocate Jim Brown's American Program and Life Management Skills, because you can have more degrees than a thermometer and not be able to find your way out of a one-room apartment with an exit sign over the door, because common sense is really not that common. And what I found in the 30 years that I've been working with Jim is the overlap, because what you do is a facsimile of the life management skills, but it's after the damage has already been done that you have to, you know, begin to try to reconstruct somebody, right? And our aim is to be able to apply the rudiments of the American curriculum at the middle school level, the high school level, and in some instances at the collegiate level, so that in support of everything else that's going on, you're constantly in touch with the responsibility of self-determination, and in many instances, overcoming childhood conditioning that wasn't all of that favorable, you know, because we still have to recognize who we're dealing with. The family was the core when we were at the height of our productivity in this country. I'm talking about the 20s, 30s, 40s, where we didn't have no choice but to just stay close to one another.
Sure.
And the village didn't allow you to get off that track.
Right.
You see what I mean? But now everything is broken into these factions, right? And, you know, everything divides us. You know, if you're a Q, you don't deal with the Kappas. If you're a Protestant, you don't deal with the Catholics. I mean, it's just all of these divisive things when we still have this one singular problem. And as is any of us that's sitting at this table, when we walk in the room, you don't even have to walk in the room. You can tell black people over the phone. So until that
especially
turns into
country
a
black folks.
Yeah, oh, my goodness.
In DC folks.
So we have to embrace the reality of that and then change the paradigm to the point where when you think of blackness, you think of excellence. You think of responsible people. You think of conscious people. You think of productive people. And it starts with the collaboration of people who individually have fought the good fight and ran the good race. And now with this object of this show going forward each and every week is about best practices and models of possibility. And on that note, as we get within the last 5 minutes of the show, I'm constantly spinning these wheels and bringing people to the table from different walks of life. I've known this brother who I'm going to bring to just come and get with us right now. Just come on over here, Victor. Victor represents how we're going to start linking and looping things. Man, just come around where you can get on camera. Between these two brothers right here is fine. And
Victor, why don't you take these? I'll stand behind you. Great, take my seat, man.
See how we operate,
take my seat, man.
That's country, boy. That's country, man. Country Vic.
Victor, Victor, too, man.
Okay,
that's a good Victor for a Victor.
How your brothers doing?
Yeah,
all right.
So
I'm gonna stay on camera.
Yeah, see, the reason I asked Victor to come in here today, what's the name of the company you work with, brother?
Exquisite Transportation.
Black-owned
limousine
service, right?
Steve Henderson is my boss.
Okay, and I've known this brother socially for a long time, and the key thing we had to do is turn social relationships into business relationships. And I kept running into him, and he's always been prompt and timely, and he's got that winning personality. And I stopped him a few weeks ago, and I said, man, we need to talk about a couple of things, man, because we were just social. And then I realized, I said, now, one of the things that we can do that's low-hanging fruit is find a brother that's in the business of transportation, and anytime folks come into town, let's make sure that this brother and the name of the company is
Exquisive.
Get that first phone call. It may not always work. I know you use Uber a lot when you're in the city, you know, but my goal is to start linking people that have like I say, the low-hanging fruit services, mm-hmm. you know, because a lot of times as a people, we just don't consciously realize how much money we just give back to people right. when we got qualified folks right in our midst right. to do the same thing.
Correct.
And do it well. So mm-hmm. the object of this show, again, is models of possibility and best practices, and that's why I asked you to come in here.
Thank
because
you.
That's what we want to do is start putting people in positions where they can be a part of this without having to go out and do anything new, mm-hmm. all right? And we want to start bringing that money back. And then as the concept goes that I was a part of back in the 80s, recycling black dollars, it was a mantra more than it was a methodology.
Correct.
I mean, it sounds good, but it's hard to do it too many times because there's too many folks that are in the business of being in business mm-hmm. instead of taking care of business. All right.
Correct.
So let's build on small successes. And what I'm going to do at this point as we begin to, you know, wind down the show is final comments, man. Whatever's on your heart to say right now, you got 60 seconds, Brother Jerry.
60 seconds. Okay.
Yeah, it's a long time on radio.
I just want to say one thing. I met this guy. Well, we met each other playing ball, but I did a movie called The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh.
Mm.
And the dude that was in that movie was Dr. Julius Erving.
That's him. Yeah.
The doctor was, and man, he's one of the nicest guys that I've ever met. And it's like, it was something like what he said. We were in Las Vegas for a Retired Players Association meeting, and I was standing over there, and I heard Doc say, somebody said, oh, man. He's the bad guy in The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh. Oh, Doc, man, he's a mean dude, man. And I heard Doc, me and him, we talked and everything, but I heard Dr. J say, Jerry Chambers? Oh, man, Jerry Chambers is one of the nicest guys I've ever met. I said, wow. Mm-hmm. I said, Dr. J said that about me. I could hear him, mm-hmm. you know, but he wasn't talking. He was talking to somebody. He said, man, he's one of the nicest guys I've ever met. And that's... I don't know why I brought that story up to say to fill the 60 seconds, but yeah. I'd like to say that Dr. J, he's also a guy that I model. I took a lot of kids and modeled him to model after him also of how to play the game of basketball and how to present yourself playing that game. And Dr. J was one of the night. He played, he dunked on you and everything like that. But he was always a gentleman.
You know.
He was always a gentleman. And for him to say that about me, I never knew that he thought that about me.
Well, here's why it's important that you use that example. For the people that are young that are listening to this, if you watch how the way Magic Johnson does business, LeBron and all of them, they're modeling because he was the first person that got with another brother. That did the Coca-Cola. Remember, they owned those Coca-Cola distributorships back in the day.
Right.
So not only was he a pioneer in terms of, you know, setting a certain kind of style standard, he actually went into business while he was playing. So I'm going to turn at this point to you, my brother, final comments.
I think, you know, when you think about the sports and the business of sports and entertainment, is really that most people don't realize how brilliant you are to be an athlete or an entertainer. That's a level of commitment and discipline that few people have. Right? You eat it, you sleep it, you breathe it. And even if you're not successful, you still are an entertainer, you're still an artist, you're still an athlete.
Mm.
And I think that once we take that drive and help people see that the same drive you have for your craft goes to, you know, your mental health, your economic development, your education, all these things, then you're going to be successful no matter what you do.
Thank you.
Because if you're not just an athlete, you will be successful across the board. Bro.
Well, the reason I know that this brother's going to be back on because you're going to get progress reports each week we're building. How do we get in touch with you if we want transportation services?
You can go online. Transportation, Exquisite Transportation. Mm-hmm. You can call.
What's right
down
number?
Right down here on Inglewood Avenue in Florence. Mm-hmm. I think it's the Tappanappy Building.
Yeah.
You go in there and ask
Exquisite
for
Transportation. Exquisite Transportation.
It's black owned and we're going to give you the top of the line transportation.
Okay. Hey, Brother Vic. The other Vic. What, are you on strike or something? You better come and get your 60 suckers, man. We wrapping up, man. Yeah. Oh, you done that, but you know, come on, man.
And when you come down there, just tell them that Victor sent you.
All right. You, know? You got 60, man. Take us on out today, man.
Six minutes.
Yeah.
Basically, I received some very wise words today. And those words were, regardless of how people treat you, keep your head up and stay moving, and everything will work out okay.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this has been another edition of Uncle Bobby's Country Corner, where real men don't play. And always, thank you for letting me be myself. We'll see you next week.